It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, why marrying someone from a different economic class can be challenging and how to work through it.
First, a magazine editor from Eau Claire recently made the argument that Wisconsin's communities need more free, interesting events to give people something to do.
These hangables, as he calls them, could include free outdoor movie showings, farmers markets, or really any community event that encourages socializing and is broad enough that most anyone could enjoy it.
We talked with Nick Meyer, the editor, publisher, and owner of Volume 1 magazine and the local store in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He also wrote the piece, Are Hangables a Key to Community Success? And we started the conversation by asking what he means when he talks about hangables.
Well, you know, a lot of us go to events. We go to concerts. We go to film screenings, theater events, sporting events. All these things have frequently a cost, not always, but sometimes they also have a specific start time. You have to be there at a certain time. You have to leave at a certain time. And a lot of times they're kind of a niched out interest. You know, if you're into theater, that's great. If you're into sports, that's great. A lot of times those crowds don't always mix. But a hangable is something that is broad enough that some part of it speaks to somebody else in a different way, and another part might speak to someone else in a different way. And it's free, and you can kind of come and go whenever you want. And it's not at a bar. It's not at a theater. But it works for families. It works for date nights. It works for any number of things.
Well, tell us some examples from your community, Eau Claire, that fit that model.
Sure. You know, here we have a lot of the things that you have in a lot of communities. There's a very successful farmers market here that's more of a morning event, but that tends to work for a lot of different people as an interesting thing to do. We'll have several thousand people here downtown Eau Claire on a Saturday morning throughout the summer and into the fall. We have a Volume 1, actually. We produce a concert series on Thursday nights that's free for the community that'll get a couple thousand people on the banks of the river here. And we have a Banbury art crawl at a huge old facility here that's been turned into a bunch of artists. But that's only once a year that happens, and that's kind of most of the list. Everything else tends to be, very niche activities, whether you're interested in live music or not. But so when this hit me, it was sort of at our store here, at the local store in Eau Claire, we started producing an event called the Night Market, where it has a little bit of live music, it has a food truck, it has tastings, sales, and different makers from throughout the community that all come, and it's all free, and it lasts for several hours, so you can come and go whenever you want. And it just sort of struck me that we had so much success with the first couple of those that it's just clear that there was a thirst for more of that kind of broad, open-ended event.
And are you looking particularly at night and evening? Because I think of a lot of towns, you know, there's stuff, obviously people are working during the day, they're going out for dinner at dinner time, but then it's a ghost town except for maybe a bar here or there. Is that what you're trying to fill in?
Well, right. I mean, if you don't have a set plan or you don't have tickets to a show already or some specific, you know, thing that you're going to, this is the kind of thing that you can just casually roll into. And, you know, there's such a scene outside and around our building with this because it's, you know, with the night market, there come all these lights and these things that we have outdoors, and that if you're just driving by, it's an easy thing to just drop into and see. And there's a great energy and, you know, dozens and dozens of people in there that are just kind of taking it all in.
Now, for a lot of people in Wisconsin, in the evening, you know, a lot of the social life can not revolve around, but at least include, you know, a bar or having
right.
drinks. Is this something about an alternative aspect to you of offering something that is sort of more family friendly?
Well, that's where I think it's about, you know, when you talk about nightlife in a community, downtowns are, you know, need to be centers of nightlife a lot of times, and nightlife tends to mean a bar. Again, it can mean a theater event or something, but that speaks to a certain community and a certain crowd and an important one, but there's another whole set of people that may not be interested in spending any time in a bar or, for that matter, in a theater, and just need more things to do. And so, yeah, an evening-based activity that's free and that can check off all these different boxes, we're finding that, at least in this community, there's a huge thirst for it.
We're talking to Nick Meyer from Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. He's making the case that his community, other communities, need more what he's calling hangables, places, spaces, events. They're free where people come, show up, no set start time. There might be stuff to buy, stuff to eat, stuff to do. You can join in. Do you have something like this, or do you want something like this in your own community? Post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Nick, when we think of hanging out these days, a lot of people are hanging out at home, on the internet, interacting with others that way. Why do we need this in-person thing in our communities?
No, that's a great question. I mean, and I think all nightlife and all entertainment-based activities in all of our communities are struggling with that, you know, the Netflix and chill movement where people just spend time at home, you know, in front of the TV or in front of the computer, and that's great a lot of the time, and that's important, you know, with your family and your friends. But, you know, our communities are built around social interaction. They're built around the third places. You have your home, you have your work, and you have your third places, which are coffee shops and yes, bars and parks and plazas and things. And that's a very important part of community life. And if we're going to bring people back out of their homes and off of those TV screens and computer screens, we need to engage them. And we can't just scold them or expect them to do it. There has to be a very active approach to programming. And that can come from a city, from a governmental body. It can come from private businesses like what we're doing here. But somebody has to take the lead, or multiple people have to take the lead, to kind of try to keep people engaged with not only their downtowns but their communities overall.
And so, Nick, what do you think the pluses are for communities with more of these hangable events? What does the community itself get out of it?
Well, I think when you get, in our case, we're going through a very significant downtown revitalization right now. There are major construction projects happening here. There are hotels opening. There are new apartment buildings going up and commercial spaces and old buildings being rehabbed and brand new ones going up. And to really expose everybody to what's happening in our downtowns, and this revitalization is happening around the state in lots of communities our size and bigger and smaller, but to really get, you need that broad cross-section to get exposed to these things, to come down and have some sort of positive experience, so they then become hungry for that next positive experience. And those become opportunities to support the businesses and the ideas and the arts groups and the nonprofits that produce all of this stuff. And pretty soon you develop a, you know, kind of this mind hive or this cycle of interest and support from a much broader segment of the community.
Let's bring in a caller. We've got Matt on the line with us from Madison. Matt, hi.
So I'm a recent transplant from the Bay Area, and in the San Francisco Bay Area, they had a website called FunCheap.com that listed all of sort of the fun, free events all throughout the Bay Area, and it was a great resource for similar events that you're talking about.
Matt, and would you go on that and go find a free thing and just show up and hang out?
All the time. It was great, you know, instead of going to bars or instead of, you know, spending $30 on a ticket to go see a concert. It was a great event. It was a lot of cultural events, and were put on by different, you know, restaurants or stores to sort of promote themselves, but always, you know, very inexpensive or free.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Nick?
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, that's the core of what we do. I mean, at Volume 1, yes, we have a store here, but, you know, at volume1.org, we serve that same thing in our community. And all of these communities in Wisconsin and abroad have a media group or something who are promoting that sort of information and providing those listings of free activities. And in the case of, he mentioned the businesses, you know, promoting themselves. And honestly, with our store, that's why we started this in part, was, well, let's get some people in here in October, which tends to be a slower retail month. And so we took these Friday nights. But what's really cool about it is that people can come and it's free, and, you know, obviously we would love for them to shop and spend money here, but there's no pressure for anyone to do that. When you go to a bar with friends or someone, you kind of feel like maybe you have to buy a drink. If you go to a restaurant, you feel like, well, I should really, you know, I should buy something. In a retail environment, there's really no pressure to do that. You can just shop for fun and check it out. But if you bring a critical mass of people and you get the energy kind of stirred up and exciting, that's how, you know, a private business or a community body can monetize this and fund producing events like this, is by creating an environment where you don't have to spend money, but there's a bunch of options to do it if you would like to.
Now, we saw a picture online of one of the events that you're writing about, and it's outside. There are people strolling around. So, of course, it's warm enough. What do you do in the winter when no one wants to hang out outside?
But yeah, this event, the night market, is kind of an indoor-outdoor thing. There's kind of both options. So you can kind of hedge your bets on those October nights that can be gorgeous or too cold, and there's different components. We also produce an event here in January and February, along with the Parks and Recreation Department of Eau Claire, called Winter After Hours, which is very much just 100% outdoors. It's a skating event. You can try snowshoeing for the first time. We have our Eau Claire's like world record winning snow carvers that do carvings each week, and that's another event that's free. You can just be there, or you can spend some money on some food or some beverage while you're there. So we try to just embrace the cold as much as possible and get people. This is part of who we are. We live in Wisconsin. We can't hide all winter, risking our seasonal affective disorder kicking in. You got to get outside. You got to embrace it. We're from Wisconsin. We live here. Let's love it. At least as much as you can wince through that, I guess.
We're talking to Nick Meyer right now. He's making the case for more free and fun open events for everyone in Wisconsin communities. He's got a name for them. He calls them hangables.
Does your community put on something like this, something like these hangables, like a night farmers market or other free event? Do you have an idea that you think would be good for your community? What would you like to see your city, your town do? Maybe help brainstorm what would work in an event like this. Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll hear more of the conversation after a look at some of the latest news.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion now with Nick Meyer. He wrote an article about why communities need more free, interesting events to give people something to do and ways to meet each other. He's been involved in his own community of Eau Claire to do just that.
Is there an ongoing event or a location in your community that you'd consider a hangable? What is it, and how does it encourage people of all ages to come together in a free and fun setting? Post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page and see what other people have to say while you're there. We have Kiera with us from Eau Claire as we continue our conversation with Nick Meyer from Volume 1. Kiera, hi.
Hi. First I was just going to say, being from Eau Claire, I wanted to say thanks to Volume 1 and all the great things that they've done, helped our community do in recent years. They've just done a lot of awesome stuff here.
Thank you very much.
And I was going to say, I'm a single mom with a young toddler, and it's always a struggle finding things you can do with kids and adults. And I think you guys have helped with that a lot. But one thing that I saw, I was traveling to North Carolina last summer, and I stopped at a restaurant that had an indoor and outdoor seating area with both areas, had areas for, like, families or adults to sit at tables, and then along the wall, like, toys and an indoor sandbox and all these things, so you could, like, sit and have a drink and hang out with your friends or have dinner while your kids, everyone's kids play together.
Great, Kiera, thank you for that. And what about this move to make things more friendly for families with places for the kids to be entertained where the adults can relax a little?
Yeah, that's what we've seen. I mean, with our experiment here with this night market thing so far, I mean, it's just the diversity of the crowd that has been interested in this is fantastic. I mean, you'll see college kids come in, you'll see, you know, young professionals on a date come in, and you'll definitely see, you know, the families coming as well. And I think that's one of the keys to success of things like our farmers market here or the concert series we produce in the summer, is that it just feels cool to anybody. You don't have to have such a specific interest in a specific area. It's just a great social event for the whole community, and it feels good no matter who you're there with or what age, and no one feels like they're not supposed to be there, that this is too cool for me and my kids, or that this is lame because all these families are here if you're young. You have to find something that works for everybody and has a little bit of offering that keeps everybody into it. And one of those, I mean, it can't be one thing either. When you get to a hangable, you have to have a good half a dozen at least, if not 10 plus different components that make this place something. It's like the power of 10 is a theory in community building and development, that to have any kind of thriving community, you have to have 10 different areas in that community that have stuff happening. And within each one of those 10 areas, like a downtown, you have to have 10 different sort of districts within that. And then when you get into that, you get just down into 10, 10, 10. When you get into that one business or that one park, there have to be 10 different things to do there in order to reach that critical mass. And that's when you're onto something, and that's when you start to see the success and things click and feel right.
Kiera, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Dimitri on the line in Milwaukee. Dimitri, hi.
Hi there. I'm in Milwaukee, and so lucky enough where there's quite a few of these that are all around the city. And I guess I just had two comments, or maybe a comment and a question. One of the last callers that said that in the Bay Area they had some sort of special source that lists these. I think that's a fantastic idea, and unfortunately we don't have something like that here. So if you're moving and you're new to the city, you might not know about the plethora of events that are out there. So that might be great. And then another, this is more of a question, is if I were a business owner, I would be listening and going, you know, that sounds great, but I wonder how much work is involved. and getting all sorts of government permits and whatever I need in order to make sure that this happens, because I bet that that's probably a stumbling block in terms of getting events off the ground.
Dimitri, thanks for that call. Let's take that last point. How much, if it's just, say, a business owner trying to take the lead on this, how challenging is this?
Well, that's a great point and a great idea. A lot of times it's not as challenging as people think it is, especially if it's a business owner and you have your own private property. 9 times out of 10, you can do anything you want for the most part. Depending on your municipality, yeah, there's going to be different levels of permits for different things. And I'll go ahead on statewide radio here and say we are an organization that seeks forgiveness instead of permission on these things. And that's my number one piece of advice. If you want to make something like this happen, just do it first. Make it happen. And then deal with, you know, with some of the things later on. I mean, everybody has to have their own level of comfort with that. But we've had a lot of success with our community and have a great relationship with our city and Parks and Rec and everybody else here. And we've worked with everybody on something or another over the last 12-plus years. But just make it happen and then figure it out. If it's a cool thing that the community wants and it becomes clear to the powers that be that hold the power over permits and things that this should happen, they're going to work with you to make it happen. Whereas if you ask too many questions up front, you might get some no's. Pretty soon the wind is out of your sails and nothing happens. So just move forward, make it work.
Okay, we heard it from you. Yes. The city call up and complain. So, Nick, you know, is there something special about Eau Claire that makes this kind of thing easier, that there's maybe more going on there? You've got the big arts scene, you've got restaurants, or do you think all cities have this stuff if they just look deep enough?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, they all have it. I mean, everybody has their own assets to work with and their own pluses and minuses. Eau Claire happens to be kind of on fire right now with a population who is just kind of awakening to itself over these last handful of years and what's really possible here. And you're hearing a lot more yeses to things these days than you're hearing no's, that you can't do that here, or we've never done it that way before. Those things are kind of evaporating in Eau Claire, and I'm not sure if that's the case elsewhere. But so there's really a culture of let's make some awesome stuff happen right now. And so we're taking advantage of that as much as we can. There are lots of other groups in this community that are stepping up to do the same thing. And success breeds success. You know, once you see one thing like this, you know, whether it's a night market or a concert or a farmer's market, it just emboldens others to try the same thing. And pretty soon you've got, you know, a pretty hot cultural scene on your hands, you know, at whatever scale, whether it's Milwaukee size scale or Eau Claire size scale or even smaller than that. Any advancement is good no matter, you know, what size community you're dealing with.
Talking to Nick Meyer from Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire about creating a fun community events. Free is the key, he says, to bring people together, bring people into downtown areas. We go back to our callers with Deborah in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hi. This may seem very simple, and it is. That's why I think it's doable. But, you know, if you want people to form a community, you have to communicate. And I think, you know, in Brown Deer, the village of Brown Deer, and in Milwaukee, there's no benches or to sit on and where people talk. I talk to people all the time. We have conversations standing up. And, I mean, I just think, like in my hometown, I came back from a week ago, Marquette, Michigan. There's picnic tables everywhere, benches to sit on, bike racks everywhere. I mean, it was just amazing. And I just think people should... You shouldn't have to go to a park to sit down on a bench and talk to somebody.
Deborah, thanks a lot for that call. So getting the infrastructure in place on a daily basis, she's saying, but that might make it easier to set up a space for the hangables you're talking about, Nick.
Right. I mean, and, you know, every community has some group of people that are in charge of these sorts of things. And sometimes it might you don't always assume that there's no budget for these things. There are business improvement districts and things who might be even sitting on some money and they don't have ideas for necessarily what to do with it. And any active citizen with an idea can come before those groups or join those groups, even better, and start directing how some of these funds should be used or how we can raise funds for it or even having an event like this to raise money to do more things like this. So, you know, it's not hard to step up and get involved. And sometimes the smaller the community, the easier it is to make things happen. So, get out there and talk to them and get your benches, get whatever it is that you have that your community needs.
So you've got your night farmers market, you've got your art crawl. What other ideas are in the pike for Eau Claire and sort of this hangable
sure.
aspect of things?
Well, I mean, a major thing that a topic here has been this Confluence Arts Center, which is a massive $75 million development right at the core of downtown Eau Claire, where our two rivers come together. And right now, at my office window, I can see, you know, there's the apartment building and commercial mixed use building with restaurants and things on the river that is going up right now. They're just finishing up fundraising for the art center. In between those two buildings is a public plaza that's going to be going in. Eau Claire is award-winning on many lists for its park system, meaning more grass and trees and trails and amazing bike trails throughout the whole city. But what we don't have is a really good public plaza, more of that urban environment. You know, it's basically a park, but more of like an urban park that's paved in some way. And that's what we're going to get now. And so they're finalizing what the offerings in that sort of space are going to be. But that's the perfect sort of space for a hangable. A park might be a little bit sprawling sometimes, but a really good plaza in a dense urban area can really be activated day or night as a truly perfect hangable type of space if the right programming happens in it. And sometimes that programming can happen organically by the community. Sometimes it can be more planned by a nonprofit or a business or the government itself. But somewhere or another, you have to activate those spaces and make them vital.
And Nick, very briefly, it sounds like any of this would take a spark plug, somebody to take the lead. Very brief pep talk for somebody who might take that step.
It's got to be you. It's not going to be somebody else. You have to, if you need something, if you see something needs to be done, don't start asking who should do this, because you're the person who's supposed to do it. So make the phone calls, get to the meetings, and take action, and pretty soon you're going to find yourself in a leading role.
Nick, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Nick Meyer, editor of Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire, discussing the importance of free, fun events and bringing communities together.
Coming up, we look at what challenges you might face if you marry someone from a different economic class. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now it's time for news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's not hard to find unethical behavior in the world around us. There are a lot of examples of government officials, corporate leaders, popular athletes, and others bending or breaking the boundaries of ethical behavior. But where do we go to find examples for good ethical behavior?
One possible solution? Go to the experts, the people who make their living studying, thinking about it, teaching the subject. Ethic professors around the country spend so much time exposed to these discussions, so you'd think they might hold themselves to a higher ethical standard.
Not necessarily, according to our next guest. Eric Schwitzgebel is a professor of philosophy at the University of California at Riverside. His recent piece on this topic, called Cheeseburger Ethics, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So when you started asking ethics professors and researching their behavior, did you expect that maybe, hey, these ethics people are going to show more signs of ethical behavior?
I thought it was possible. I wasn't sure exactly how it would turn out. They certainly spend a lot of time thinking about ethical issues and sometimes have pretty strong moral opinions you might think they would act in accord with.
And what kind of questions did you cover with these experts?
So I've looked at a variety of different kinds of behavior. One set of measures asked them to evaluate the morality of different types of behavior and then self-report their own behavior on those same issues. Other things that we've done is look directly at their behavior without looking at self-reports.
And so you're talking about things like what? Donating to charity? What other kinds of behavior?
Right. So in the self-report measures, we looked at donating to charity, at vegetarianism, whether they embrace the idea that you shouldn't eat the meat of mammals, and we looked at whether they were likely to call their mothers. We looked at responding to student emails. We looked at whether they voted in public elections, whether they were blood donors, those sorts of things, several measures like that.
Was it one, did you join or were you sympathetic with the Nazi Party?
Yeah, so another study that we did was we looked at historical records from the 1930s on the rate at which philosophers joined the Nazi Party or were in some way severely punished by the Nazis. And we found that professors of philosophy were at least as likely as professors in other academic departments to be involved with the Nazi Party and more likely to be Nazi Party members than were members of the general public at that time.
Now that's a pretty huge question. With all the other things you looked at, though, what was the bottom line? How did they measure up? Are these ethics professors better than the rest of us?
So we did not find, so most of this is with collaboratively with Josh Rust at Stetson University, I should say. We did not find that ethicists behaved any differently, any better or worse overall than any of the other groups of participants we looked at.
Now, informally, you also, you spoke to some religious leaders about whether these people in the religious community would be more ethical. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so regularly whenever I meet someone who is a clergy member in some religion, I ask whether that person thinks the clergy behave any better than lay people in the same religion. And what I've found universally is that the clergy will say no to that. Typically, they'll say, well, they might say that the clergy behave about the same. Some of them will say the clergy actually behave a little worse. I haven't yet had any clergy tell me that clergy behave better than lay people, although I'm sure some probably do have that opinion.
So, Eric, I'm a little worried here. The people you'd expect maybe to be more ethical aren't. So I guess the big question is why? Why don't these people who spend all their time wrestling with ethics and moral quandaries, why don't they take that mental work and translate it into real life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. I think there are several possible explanations. I think one possible explanation is that most people do not aim to be morally better than their peers, particularly. They aim to be about the same morally as their peers, right? So if you see other people cheating and getting away with it, then you want to cheat and get away with it too. So we're not aiming maybe to be saints, and that might include ethics professors and even clergy. They want to do what everyone does. So you look around, you might see your moral standards changing. You might decide, well, look, people should give more to charity, or maybe people should be vegetarian, or people should be really conscious about participating in democracy, those sorts of things. But if you don't see other people around you doing that same thing, you might think, well, why should I if other people are not?
Talking to Eric Schwitzgebel, he's a philosophy professor, and he's delved into the issue of ethical behavior, asking the question, do people who study ethics, who research this, behave better than the rest of us? Short answer, no, not really. We want to hear from you and how this plays out in your daily life at 800-642-1234. If you think you're an ethical person, where did that come from? What motivates it for you? And why do you think, even if we think about this stuff, why don't we always live up to our own ethical standards? 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And Eric, do you think there could be anything going on here that would be similar to carbon credits? In this case, you know, you think about ethics, you study ethics, therefore you get a little license to be a little less ethical because you're thinking about it.
Yeah, so there is some evidence in the psychological literature for what's sometimes called moral licensing or moral self-licensing. The idea that when you do something good, that gives you some permission to do something bad a little later. So if you do something good, such as buy an environmentally green product, the evidence suggests that you might then be a little less cooperative or nice in a subsequent interaction with someone else because you've kind of like just proven to yourself, hey, I'm pretty good, right? If we're aiming for mediocre, which is, I think, one possibility, you know, if people are aiming for mediocre and then they do something that's good, then that they give themselves a little bit of a license to do something a little bad later on because otherwise, you know, they'd be maybe aiming a little too high.
Now, if the ethics experts and anyone else has this gap between their ethical belief system, their moral beliefs, and how they actually behave, how they don't live up to it, I mean, does that make us all hypocrites? Can we be judgy about ourselves on this?
You know, I don't like the word hypocrite in this context. I think I actually admire people who have high moral standards, even if they don't live up to them. So take someone who maybe has very high standards for environmentalism, an issue you just raised, right? But doesn't quite live up to them. Compare that person with someone who says, I don't care about the environment at all, and engages in all kinds of polluting behavior, right? I like the, I think in the second case, not necessarily more admirable person than someone who has high standards but doesn't quite live up to them.
Why do you think people don't want to take the moral high ground, especially these people who study ethics, because apparently it fascinates them. Why do you think these people especially don't want to be the examples for everyone to look up for? Why are even they aiming for mediocrity?
Well, I think some people are really invested in seeing themselves as morally far superior to their peers. But those people are often not, in fact, superior. And maybe the rest of us see ourselves as, you know, morally okay, morally B+, maybe not super wonderful, but also hopefully, you know, pretty good. It might be, to really be a saint might require more sacrifice than people are willing to make.
Let's bring a caller in on this. We've got Sherry on the line in Madison now. Sherry, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think, Sherry?
The comment I have regarding ethical behavior among ethicists is that it is much easier to be judgmental or have a judgment about someone else's ethical behavior than it does your own. You can always defend what others would see as unethical behavior.
And do you have a first-hand experience in this field, Sherry?
Well, I am on an ethics commission in a county and have been on an ethics committee in a healthcare setting where we would deal with end-of-life decisions. But I do say being on an ethics commission and that being an important personal value, when I'm about to do something that might have ethical implications, it does give me pause. Hmm.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. So she's in a little more of a hands-on position maybe than the ethics professor, Eric, and she says the experience setting in ethical standards for others makes her think twice in some of her own behavior.
Right. And that seems right, but she also said something that kind of might counterbalance that to some extent, right? So she started by mentioning that people, that it's very easy to come up with justifications or rationalizations for your own behavior. Easier maybe than, and it's easy to judge other people and to kind of excuse yourself. So I'm kind of inclined to think that there might be two kind of competing factors here for people who are on ethics commissions and for people who are ethics professors, right? One is an enhanced salience of and perhaps interest in theoretical ethics, which might push you toward better moral behavior, right? But on the other hand, there might be an increased capacity or interest in or availability of different manners of excusing oneself, where you can come up with, if you're a good, talented enough ethicist, you can come up with a theory to defend almost anything, right? So those two pressures might approximately counterbalance in a way that the behavior ends up not changing.
Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to Davriel in Eau Claire. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you think about this ethical quandary?
Well, so I think it's important, similar to your previous caller, to understand the role that the people's own personal justifications of their behaviors have. So I've spent some time in the military, and something that they really preach is the role of bystanders and, you know, their ability to positively alter a situation. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is to not absolve yourself based on the actions of those around you, but to look at a situation singularly as yourself and just question, what will I do? As opposed to, you know, what are others around me doing?
Great point. Thank you for that, Davriel. And is that something people should be thinking about as they consider their ethics, not to judge against the herd, but to chart their own moral path forward?
Yeah, I do think that is an important factor that can lead one to behave morally better than one otherwise would. On the other hand, of course, it can also go the other direction. I kind of sense my empirical data suggests that there's no change overall. Usually when I see something that is good, I also think about what the flip side of it might be. And one flip side of kind of moral independent thinking is that the herd might be right. And you, and when you're thinking independently of the herd, you might, if you're inclined to justify something that you want to do that most people might think was bad, right? But you're an independent thinker. You arrive at your own moral judgment. It might be a wrong moral judgment that's kind of self-flattering, self-excusing. So independent moral thinking, I think, is a two-edged sword.
Hmm.
Not that I discourage it, but I think we want to, you know, just recognize that.
We're talking to Eric Schwitzgebel. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, about ethics and ethical behavior. He's done some philosophical research. He found that people who study ethics aren't necessarily more ethical than anybody else. So studying the stuff doesn't make us better people. What could?
And we want your answer to that question at 800-642-1234. What makes you behave ethically? Is it your religious belief or maybe a personal philosophy? Do you have a role model? Do you take the time to ponder ethical dilemmas? And if so, do the answers you come up with actually shape the way that you behave? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with philosophy professor Eric Schwitzgebel. In a recent piece, he says people who study ethics for a living don't necessarily behave more ethically than anybody else. And we're asking, what motivates you to behave ethically or not?
Call in with your answer to that question now at 800-642-1234 or share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers now. We've got David on the line in Green Bay. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I think it's really difficult for a lot of people who don't study ethics for a living to be able to understand, and I'm not just saying this as a person who really likes to think that I know everything about ethics, but to understand all the different things that play into being able to make ethical judgments at all. So to start with the premise that ethicists don't act as ethically as people who don't study ethics as much takes for granted the fact that ethicists all think that what everybody else thinks about common sense morality is true or apt about what we believe. So I, for example, study ethics an awful lot, and a lot of times I'm coming to conclusions like, well, maybe an awful lot about what people think is a good action or a bad action don't actually apply at all. And so if I actually believe there are moral truths, I'm going to act very differently than a lot of people who don't believe there are moral truths. And there are ethicists on both sides. And a lot of ethicists have to spend their entire lives trying to debate other ethicists who don't believe that there are moral truths to convince them that there are.
Interesting, David. I want to bring Eric Schwitzgebel in on this now. Eric, maybe ethicists don't live up to what we would define as ethical standards, but do they live up to their own standards, the ones that they established maybe in their own idiosyncratic ways?
Right. The evidence that we have, Josh Rush and I have, suggests that they don't live up to their own standards either, right? So we did find some issues where ethicists on average had very different opinions from non-ethicists. For example, the majority of the ethicists we surveyed said that it was morally bad to eat the meat of mammals such as beef or pork, and that was only a small minority opinion among the non-ethicists that we surveyed. And yet they self-reported eating meat at the same rate, both groups. So
I don't know about
these
ethicists.
So whether you look at kind of more conventional standards or, to the extent we can, whether you look at their own standards, it doesn't seem to be much difference in the behavior, at least on the measures we've looked at so far.
Let's go next to Sherry, who joins us from cable. Sherry, hi.
Hi. I believe that when you're a child and you grow up with your parents as role models, hopefully good role models, for 18 years of your life, you formulate a good ethics base if you are being role modeled that. And secondly, I believe base is huge in your ability to do what is the right thing to do.
Sherry, thank you for those thoughts. She's talking about the parental role there that our ethical grounding takes because of our parents, our upbringing, and also faith. So to take that last angle, did you look at all about ethicists who were adherents to particular religions, any differentials there?
So I haven't looked at ethicists' religious affiliations, but there is a literature in social psychology on the relationship between religiosity and different kinds of ethical behavior or criminal behavior. And the findings there are disputed. My particular reading of them is that the religiosity is not very predictive of moral or immoral behavior. Now, that there may be some forms of religiosity that are predictive, but there might. But it seems like, if so, there are other forms of religiosity that might be negatively predictive, right? Religion can be an occasion to be motivated to act morally, but it can also be an occasion to privilege your group over someone else's group, or satisfy certain kinds of moral standards while rejecting others.
Talking ethics with Eric Schwitzgebel. And next on the line, we have Nick in Wauwatosa. Nick, hi.
Hi.
Nick, hi. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a mentor as I was a young man, and I look at ethics through a personal self-interest. I guess you could almost say a selfish perspective, in that if I, which happened to me not too long ago, walked out of the store without paying for something, I feel like a thief if I don't go back. And so I'm doing things because I want to feel good about myself. I'm not a saint. I'm not into necessarily self-sacrifice, but from a personal self-interest perspective, because it builds my self-image and I feel better about
Nick, thanks for the call, Eric. So a selfish motivation for virtuous ethical behavior.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call that selfish. I would call it emotional, right? Mm-hmm. So if you feel good about doing something good for someone else and feel bad about doing something bad, then some people think of that as a kind of selfishness. But I think we should call that having a good kind of moral, emotional alignment. So he's maybe a little too self-critical along those lines.
All right, so you're a good person. Thanks a lot for that call. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
That was Eric Schwitzgebel. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. We've got a link to his recent piece on ethical behavior. It's called Cheeseburger Ethics, and the piece explains why he calls it that there, by the way. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can keep sharing your thoughts and maybe your experiences while you're there. I'd love to see what you think.
Let us know if you're selfishly ethical or
yeah.
ethically selfish.
Whoa.
I don't know.
I don't know what that means, but
it
sounds really deep. That's
cool.
Well,
you can let us know your stories over on the Central Time Facebook page.